Blog Talk Radio.
Edition here on October the 3rd, 2015. That's right, we are in fall. Things are in full swing. We got Christmas and Thanksgiving coming up, Halloween. I mean, it's just getting crazy. But what October always means to Suspense Radio is that we have one of our good friends and great authors on the show with us today. Tasha Alexander will be talking about her 10th book in her Lady Emily series called The Adventurist. Then we are going to have Jack Speller calling in from Ireland, and then Joe Clifford will be in, and that will round out our 90-minute show. But let's get to it right now. Like we said, one of the nicest people and one of the best authors we have, talked with her for like the last 5 years, I believe, in October with her latest book, The Adventurist. Yes, she's hit double digits now with the 10th one in her Lady Emily series. So it's always great to say, Tasha, thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing?
I'm good, John. It's so good to talk to you. I look forward to this every year.
Every October, we kind of mark it on the calendar. I always leave a spot open, not knowing when the date is, but I'm like, I always got to leave a spot in there. Always
I appreciate
make sure
it.
That we get you in October. And, yeah, like we were talking off the air, I guess, since it's the 10th book, I guess you have to say that Lady Emily's pretty much a success, right?
It's kind of astonishing to me. I remember it's just, you know, it's the sort of thing that you can't let yourself hope for, you know? So it's pretty astonishing to be here. And I remember the very first time I talked to my agent, you know, before when she had taken me on and she was getting ready to go out and sell the first book. And she asked me what my goal was. She said, what are you looking for here? And I said, what I want is to, in 10 years, still have a contract. And so that happened. So that's
there
pretty amazing. That's a good agent.
That is. 10 years later, here we are, and you know what? And that is an astonishment in itself, but not just that. It's because, you know, every October, you're taking us back to Victorian London. You're taking us out of the time of technology, of CSI, of forensics, of all that stuff that is cluttering up all the thrillers and the suspense now, and it's still going strong, so it's still a very viable genre that, you know, you are one of the heads of.
Yeah, I think the thing with historicals is that they, by not having the technology, you know, the human side of them is still so relevant today. People don't change. And when you strip away the technology and the forensics and all that, you're left with kind of the more fundamental human condition.
Right,
and I
like
think,
Sherlock Holmes, like Hercule Poirot, you have to actually be somebody who talks with people anymore, right?
Exactly. Although I may have said this to you before, but there have been times when I'm writing where I think, oh, it would be so much easier if she had a cell phone. Can't she just blow something up?
Right.
It's true. But then on the other hand, I think you get that can be a limitation when you're writing contemporaries. How do you have your protagonist isolated when everyone knows she has a cell phone? You know.
Right.
So that definitely has its burdens as well. But there are times when I just think, but it forces you to really put yourself in a more creative space when you can't rely on any of the contemporary things that can make life easier.
Yeah, it definitely makes characters deeper. It makes you have to think a lot more because, like you said, they just can't whip out the cell phone. They just can't find that, you know, go down to the police lab and find the DNA report, you know, a month later or whoever and go arrest somebody. It's much different. And so every novel, you have to kind of challenge yourself in a way. So
exactly.
In The Adventurist, what was your challenge in The Adventurist now that you kind of had to put out there with Lady Emily? Give us, let's just jump right into it and give us the insight on this one now.
Yeah, so with The Adventuress, I brought back a character, Jeremy Sheffield. He's the Duke of Bainbridge. He's one of Emily's best friends from the time they were little kids. His father's estate is next to her father's estate, and they've always been very good friends. And Jeremy, because he's a duke, you know, he really needs to get married and have a child, a son, so that there's another duke. You know, you have to make sure that the line is continuing. And Jeremy mm-hmm. really is not interested in this. Jeremy likes to think of himself as a ne'er-do-well, but he's really a basically good guy. But he's also always been a little bit in love with Emily, and he kind of uses that as his excuse, sort of facetiously, but, you know, there's always truth in a joke, right? There's always a little bit of truth. So he kind of has used that as an excuse to not get married. And in this book, and, you know, I think Emily kind of enjoys that. You know, she is madly in love with her husband, but none of us object to being a little bit admired, right? You know?
Right, and I get you.
So in The Adventuress, what I wanted to do is I wanted to explore Emily having to come to terms with the fact that she was no longer, you know, Jeremy's best friend. Jeremy has met an American heiress, Amity Wells, falls madly in love with her almost immediately, and is getting married. And in the book, they are in the south of France, in Cannes, where Amity's mother has planned a very extravagant engagement celebration, really a vacation. So they're down there, and, you know, Amity is perfect. She's beautiful. She's charming. She's funny. She's, you know, engaging, and everyone loves her, but she bugs Emily. And so Emily's having to deal with, you know, thinking, am I being hard on this woman simply because, you know, she's not jealous. She's not in love with Jeremy, but this woman is coming in and changing her friendship. And mm-hmm. that's not an easy thing to deal with. And so wanted to really kind of delve into the emotion of that. How do you deal with, you know, when your best friend gets married, your friendship does change a little bit. And
right.
so Emily's dealing with that, but everyone from the outside is looking in at her and saying, oh, come on, no, you're just jealous. You like Jeremy being in love with you. And so when she starts to criticize Amity or notice that things aren't quite right with Amity, she finds that all the people around her are kind of coming down hard on her, assuming that her own motives aren't necessarily pure, shall we say.
And that is, in turn, I guess, what leads to the apparent suicide, but
yeah.
maybe something far more sinister.
Exactly. Yeah, so at the very beginning of the book, Emily is awakened, and Colin, and they're awakened in the middle of the night in their hotel room. Someone from the hotel has come to tell them that the English Duke is dead, because a dead body has been found in Jeremy's room, and Emily thinks Jeremy's dead and is all upset, but it turns out it's not Jeremy. It's one of his friends who's down for the party who appears to have committed suicide, and Emily just thinks, no, there's no way. And the real thing that bugs her about the whole scene is that, first of all, the body is in Jeremy's room, and second of all, the instrument of death, if you will, is poison, right? And
mm-hmm.
so he supposedly, you know, has committed suicide by drinking poisoned whiskey. But the whole bottle of whiskey is poisoned, not just the glass. And the bottle of whiskey is left on Jeremy's bedside table. And Emily cannot believe that no matter how disconsolate, depressed, desolate this guy was, she can't believe that he would have deliberately gone into his friend's room, killed himself with what he knows is his friend's favorite liquor, you know, liquor of choice, right? That you
yep,
poison
yep.
the whole bottle and leave that bottle there so that he's going to come in, right, find you dead mm-hmm. on his bed. His first reaction is going to be, if you know Jeremy, he's going to pour himself a glass of whiskey. So she's saying, something's not right here, because I don't think that unless he was going for murder-suicide, you know, and that would be a weird way to do it, she does not believe that this is a simple suicide. And, of course, she's right.
Well, yeah, and then that's where the fun begins, is now trying to navigate through all of this that you've kind of thrown her into. The 10th book, there's a lot of shakeup. I mean, so you're doing a lot of navigation. You're doing a lot of different things. Would you say that this was one of Emily's more internally emotional, more emotional books that you've written with her?
Yeah, that's actually a really good insight, John. I think it is, because she is trying to come to terms with she's not proud of how she feels about Amity. She doesn't like her, and she's like, no, I'm not jealous. It's just, I just don't like her. And she knows she should, and she keeps trying to be friends with her. And so you've got that whole complicated set of emotions going on for her internally at the same time that she's trying to figure out what happened with this murder. And so she's got to, she's trying to get the investigation started, because initially it's, the coroner rules this a suicide. We're done, right? Mm-hmm. And she's saying no. And here she is. She's in France. She's not in England. So she has no pull. Colin can get a certain amount of official pull because he has an official, role in England, and he can kind of go to the police and say, hey, I need you to treat me with respect. But, she has no pull. So she's got that she is a woman in a foreign country trying to convince the authorities and her friends and her husband that something is amiss here. And at the same time, she's got all this external pressure where people are saying, look, let it go. You are just having a hard time accepting the fact that your friend's finally getting married, and you're just stirring up trouble.
Right,
makes it harder for her, yeah.
Right, there's a whole mess of stuff that, she's got to contend with in this one. So, what do you think was the most difficult part of this story for you to write, aside from maybe the other nine? Was there something that maybe stuck out with you a little bit more with this one?
Well, one thing that I wanted to do with this one is I really wanted to delve into Amity. So it's alternating chapters between Emily's point of view and Amity's point of view, because we all approach the world from our perspective, right? And Emily doesn't know Amity well. And so I wanted the reader to actually know Amity better than Emily does, so that we have more information than Emily can. Amity had been traveling with her parents. Emily was not in India with Amity. Amity was in India. Amity was in Egypt. Amity has this whole wealth of experience that has brought her to who she is and where she is when she's in Cannes for her engagement party. And I wanted us to know all that. And that's a tricky balance, because I didn't want it to be that there were things that ruin the story that we know before Emily knows, right?
Mm-hmm.
But at this stage, so it's a real delicate balance there. You want to give the reader more information without harming sort of the main narrative of the story. You want it to enhance it. You want it, because that was kind of the whole point, was that what if you see this from a bigger point of view? What if you have a broader view of this? Because how can we think about, just in any circumstance we're in, moving away from our perspective of it and trying to take in a bigger view, when at the same time we know we can't always know everything. We don't know every single person's every experience. We can't ever know that. So finding that balance was tricky. And then this book, with all my books, one of the things that's so important to me is to have a villain who we're not going to necessarily sympathize with, because, at the end of the day, we really don't think people should go around murdering people. It's not civilized.
True. I don't know. There's some people that...
there are. But see, this is it. And that's what I think is fascinating, because what I like in a mystery is I prefer a villain that I can understand. That I can say, end of the day, I wouldn't have killed that person, but that there's a reason that this person did it, that isn't just, well, I'm psychotic and crazy, or I'm a sociopath or whatever, but that this person has a situation where he thinks that in order to get what he, you know, there's something critical to his life that is going to be destroyed, ruined, whatever, if he doesn't kill this person.
Right.
And
there
the
has
thing
to
is,
be a purpose. Yeah.
Exactly. And that it's a, you know, obviously, in the end, you're always going to say, yeah, but you didn't need to kill the guy, right? But I think it's so important that we feel like, okay, yeah, I see why. I mean, we aren't going to agree necessarily, but I think it's so important to really understand that motive and then write that character in a way that the reader can then, as I said, I'm not condoning murder, but that you can see why, how, because isn't that what's interesting about murders? It's more interesting when a seemingly normal person acts in this aberrant way because they're
right.
not that far from us. So what pushed them over the line?
Yeah, I mean, you always look and you say the person next door, well, they were so nice and, you know, they kind of kept to themselves and this, and you had no
yeah.
idea. And the one thing, like you said, when you're writing and have the audience kind of knows more than the character knows, then
right.
you almost have the readers like, oh, but Emily, you're wrong like that. No, that's not the way it is. And you're kind of hoping, and I always kind of, you know, like a horror movie. It's like, why are you running up the stairs? He's up the stairs.
Hey, it's 3 in the morning. I heard this weird noise. I think I'll go into the basement by myself.
Yeah, and you're like, no, 7 people have already
right.
died. Run! So, yeah, I mean, that's the kind of thing. And I think that that's the emotional pull that a lot of readers get, and then they want to keep turning the page. They want to keep going, like, oh, my God, is she going to get it?
Yeah. And then you've got to be careful,
yeah.
of course, that you're not having your protagonist do things that are just stupid.
Right. Right,
you
got
to have
and
it that it's believable that in this situation you probably would choose to do this, even if maybe it's not
right.
the best idea
it's
from
like
a rational point of view.
Adventure. Yeah, it's
exactly.
Like, I'll go out the door instead of going out the window, even though they're both viable. You know, the window is the right way, but the door is the wrong way. But the door is still a viable option. They just picked the wrong one, but that's
right.
okay. Yeah, yeah. I think that that's a brilliant way to really engage the reader more instead of them just kind of letting the story unfold. They're really rooting now for Lady Emily to kind of figure this thing out and know a little bit less than what they know, because it might give them a little bit of an upper hand. You
That's
know, give
right.
them that little upper hand. Yeah. And now the one thing that you've also started doing is you have a 10.5 novella called That Silent Night, which is a Christmas story.
Yeah.
And this is something new that you started last year when you did the novella, and that was, 9.5, I believe, and that was Star of the East.
Right.
So now you're kind of bridging these books together, right?
Yeah, and it's been fun. With the novella for this year, I wanted to go back to what is a wonderful Victorian tradition that I've always thought sort of, I guess, as an American, you know, we don't necessarily think Christmas ghosts, right? But
right.
in England, in Britain, the tradition of the Christmas ghost story goes back well into the Victorian era, and that was a thing. I mean, you sat around on Christmas Eve and told ghost stories.
Really?
Which is
I
isn't
never
that funny?
Knew that.
Right? Yeah. I didn't know about this until it was some years back. I mean, I guess it was before I started writing. I belonged to the Folio Society, you know, which is a publisher that they reprint books in these beautiful, beautiful, you know, gorgeous editions. And I got from them a book called Christmas Ghost Stories. And I will confess that I ordered it because I just thought it was kind of hilarious. I'm like, really? Christmas
mm-hmm.
ghost stories? Because that's a thing. But then I got it, and I started reading about it, and I thought, wow, this actually is a thing. And in Britain, that's what they did. But I guess if you think about being in a big, drafty English house, you know, and you're all around the fire, and the flames are flickering, it's actually a great atmosphere
yeah.
for a ghost story. And so that became a thing, and you would sit around on Christmas Eve and tell ghost stories. And that's where, if you look at Henry James' Turn of the Screw, that is a Christmas ghost story. There is a frame, and at the beginning of the story, it's clear that this is a, that the story of the turn of the screw is being told by the narrator on Christmas Eve to his friends.
Wow.
So, I mean, you know, we just don't, like, that's not an American thing, but it is really a British thing. And so I thought, well, how fun. I want to write a Victorian ghost story. So That Silent Night is my Victorian Christmas ghost story.
Huh. And how, so, now is it out yet? I don't think it's out yet, right?
It comes out, I think, at the end of the month, at the end of the month, yeah.
Okay. So
yeah,
forward,
because, you know,
right,
we
Halloween
have
Christmas,
yeah. Yeah, well, we got, you know, we think about Christmas Carol, and obviously there are ghosts in Christmas Carol, but that always sort of seemed like sort of something of a non sequitur to me. I'm like, really? There, go, okay, whatever, go with it. But I didn't realize that that was coming from this tradition of ghosts in Christmas.
Hmm. Interesting. And so, is this going to be something that I guess readers are going to see all the time now? Are you going to kind of have a book, and then you're going to kind of do a novella? But the novella really doesn't, I guess it's not like an extension of the last book. It's just something that bridges the reader to the next one.
That's right. Well, and what I've done with the first two, and you know, people seem to like them, so I'll keep writing them as long as people want to read them, of course. My view of it is that it's, you know, it's more of a vignette, and so you can kind of pull something out. Maybe, like in this one, there's a lot about Emily and Colin's relationship and a little bit about the boys, you know, because they've got the three kids now. And mm-hmm. there are things that you can pull out that wouldn't necessarily fit into the narrative of a novel, you know, because I think it's very important.
Right.
You know, you want the characters well-developed, and you want all of the sort of relationships between friends and lovers and whoever to matter throughout the arc of the series, but you never want that to distract from the narration of the story. So you can kind of, there are some fun little things you can do in a novella, taking bits of that and kind of having it as a separate thing that fits in its own little story.
Interesting. So kind of switching gears a little bit, because we're running out of time, but we could talk for 3 hours. But,
we could.
We kind of did a little bit off the air. So you're kind of down a little bit on the conference circuit. You're not going to be out as much as maybe you were last year. Like, we finally met at VoucherCon, and so you're kind of down a little bit in the conference circuit this year, right?
Yeah, I'm not going to VoucherCon, but I am touring mm-hmm. again this year. So, you know, I do have a kid at home. I can't just be gone all the time. So
right.
So yeah. So I will tour in October and into November a little bit, but no conferencing for me this year, I'm afraid. Although I will be at Love is Murder in Chicago next year.
Now, what about Harrogate next year?
Well, you know, it's funny you mentioned that. My publisher was just saying to me, you really should go to Harrogate. And I have never been. And, you know, I would like to, because, you know, the books are all being published in the UK. And, you know, that's been going quite well. So maybe it's time to get to Harrogate.
Well, we're going. That's why I bring
Okay, well,
it up.
Then I'm sold. All right, I'm there.
See?
If I can see you guys.
We're going for the first time because, of course, you know, Peter James is like the chair. So he asked us if we could come out. They hit no American press. And it's like, you know what? We've never been to England. And we've never, so it's like, this is the perfect thing. So let's just do it.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And I said, screw it. Yeah.
Oh.
And now, of course, the unfortunate thing is it's right around Thriller Fest, so we're skipping that. But, you know, we've been there 3 years in a row. So it's time that you can take a little break and then you go back. But, yeah. So
yeah.
That's
and you guys will love England. You'll love England.
And I'm not even sure. I think Harrogate is about an hour or 2 hours north of London, or it's like out of the country, I think, right?
Yeah, it's north. It's in the north.
Yeah.
I
don't know.
It's beautiful. That part of the country is gorgeous. It's this, you know, the English countryside is just so spectacularly beautiful.
Yeah.
It's going to
be fun to see it.
Well, that's great.
And
knowing that you guys will be there really kind of spurs me to want to be there. So
yeah,
maybe I'll shoot
for
that.
We've been emailing back and forth with the chair to try to, you know, get coverage, because it's like we want to come out and cover the event, and what kind of coverage can you, you know, do you guys want, and with the magazine and doing some things. So, yeah, so that'll be good to kind of, I think Peter said there's like no American press that goes out. So
wow.
I'm like, well, we're going to do it. That's it. Time. you know.
That's brilliant.
Yeah. Well, you know what? It's like time almost for us to part ways. But give everybody again always a little bit of the social media. We touched, of course. We didn't really got into the book, The Adventures, but there's so much other stuff that happened in the series and everything. Now this is book 10. So kind of give you the last word to kind of get everybody, knowing about anything that we might not have talked about, websites and social media and the whole main thing,
Yeah, so my website is easy. It's just TashaAlexander.com. I'm on Facebook and I'm on Twitter, although I admit I'm not the world's most consistent tweeter, shall we say. But
Neither am I.
Right? It's such a time sink.
My last tweet was, what do you say if don't have anything to tweet? This is what you get. That was the last tweet I think I did.
Yeah, well, but the thing is, Twitter's fun because it is conversation. But you have to be able, you can't be in the middle of writing your book and then go hang out on Twitter for an hour chatting with people because, you
exactly.
kind of need to write the book. So, but I am, I'm around on Twitter to a degree, and that's T. Alexander is my handle, I guess, is what they call it. So.
Oh, well, I'll tell you, if we do meet up in July, at least it won't be a year till we talk again. But of course, if there's anything that you ever need from us, you can always just let us know. And we'll
thank you.
Course.
You guys are just the best, and if I can ever do anything from you, you know where to find me.
Yes, when we make it to Chicago, one of these times, maybe. You never know.
You guys need to do that. You need to come to Chicago.
I know. We're gonna work on that. Well, it's been like 95 degrees here, so it might be good to get away in Chicago and experience some 30 degree weather coming in the next couple months.
That's true. I mean, right now it's cloudy right now, but we have had the most beautiful week. It's just been gorgeous, crisp fall, sunny. Beautiful weather. So come.
Yes. All right, Tasha. All right, we'll do that, and we'll make plans, and we'll definitely get together. So I want to thank you again always so much for coming on. Love having you on. Big kudos to the book. Congratulations, and we will speak with you soon.
Thanks so much for having me. You guys are
all
the
right,
best.
Bye-bye.
All right.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So again, everybody, that is author Tasha Alexander. The latest book is called The Adventuress, number 10. In her Lady Emily series, and then coming out in about a month, you have That Silent Night, which is the 10.5, the novella, the ghost story that Tasha's now written for a Lady Emily Christmas story. So something new. So something new for the fans. She's giving it to you here. So make sure you check out The Adventuress. Go to TashaAlexander.com for more information. Buy the book wherever you buy books, Amazon, wherever you buy them. Just pick them up and get them there. And we are going to go ahead and take a quick short break. We got to tell you about one thing, though. On our website, suspensemagazine.com, we have just put up a new trailer that's on there from a company called 8 Films to Die For 2015. Go to the website and check out the trailer and look at it. I mean, if you are a horror fanatic, if you like horror movies, then they have 8 films for you that you need to make sure that you check out. So go to the website, spitzmagazine.com, click on the trailer, and check that out and see what they have going on. It's some great stuff. I could talk a long time about the 8 films, but like I said, if you like horror movies, there's something there for you. There's a lot of good stuff that they got going on. So, again, go to spitzmagazine.com and check out that trailer. We are going to be back now with our next guest. He is Jack Miller. His book is Freedom's Child. He's calling us all the way from Ireland. So make sure that you stick around and check out for that one, and we will be back in just 1 second.
Believe.
Of course, we still want to welcome coming on. It's always great to talk with Sasha. And so that's why we know it's October. Now we're going to transition into our next guest. She is the author of the book called Freedom's Child. She's calling us from Ireland. And you want to make sure that you check out the website. It's Jax, JAXMiller.com. This is the debut novel. And it's getting really, really great reviews. It came out already in England, and it's now out in the United States, so it's out in both places, which is always good because sometimes, you know, things get a little confusing. But, Jax, we want to thank you so much for coming on. So how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you doing? Thanks for having me.
We're doing great. Thanks so much for calling us all the way from Ireland. It's great to be able to speak with you and talk with you here on your debut novel called Freedom's Child. So let's just jump right into the book. And, you know, you have some powerful authors, Lee Child, Karen Slaughter, you know, that have all talked and reviewed the book. So why don't you just jump right into it and let everybody know what you got going on here?
Yeah, so Freedom's Child is my first book. It was one of those flukes, I think. I was kind of picked up overnight. And, like you said, it's been getting these really these really good reviews from Lee Child and Karen Slaughter. And I'm just over here pinching myself, like, what the heck is happening? Because it's like a dream come true, but it's so surreal. It's really wild to me. So
then jumping into the book, what are fans going to expect? You know, what have you got in store for them here?
So Freedom's Child is about this woman who put her children up for adoption 20 years ago after being accused of killing their father. And pretty much she's been stalking them for the past 20 years and watching them from afar. And she doesn't know them, of course. And she finds out that her one daughter goes missing. So she escapes the witness protection program to find the daughter that she's never known. So I guess it's pretty violent. It's pretty aggressive. It's not for everyone, but I guess if you're into like Quentin Tarantino films or something like that, because it is pretty violent, then this would probably be a book that you might enjoy. So
now, coming out of the gate with your first book, when you were figuring out what you wanted to write and what you know what kind of voice you wanted to give, Was it characters that were kind of pulling to you? Was it the story that was kind of pulling to you? What was the drive with Freedom's Child that got you to finally get down and start writing it and get it out?
You know, it's funny because I never wrote to be a writer and to have an audience. I really wrote as like this therapeutic outlet. It was just for me. So the voice isn't necessarily one I had to fiend because it really is my own voice. And when I started writing it, I was actually hitchhiking around America on a motorcycle. And it was one of those things, yeah, I started writing. I was just going through this really hard time in my life. And, you know, like Freedom, we were going through a lot of the same things. And so I created this character. I had no idea where she was going or what she was doing. But I think it was because I kind of needed this companion on the road because it was like a very lonely year or two for me. And, I created this character. I grew to really like her, and she really led the way. Like, I didn't have a story in mind, and I just created this character, and she totally led the way. So when the reader is surprised, I was just as surprised writing it. It was a really fun experience, I have to say.
Mm-hmm. And for people, of course, when they go to your website, Jax Miller, I mean, you have, like, a little kind of bio, I guess, of Freedom Oliver and, you know, who she is. But the one thing is that, you know, She's kind of had a split life because, you know, being under, you know, not being under witness protection, now being under witness protection. So she's kind of had, you know, things have been really split for her. So who would you say is Freedom? If we were to sit here and I were to be interviewing her and asking kind of questions about who she is, you know, who is she and how would she kind of answer that stuff? Give us a little insight to exactly who Freedom Oliver is as a person.
Well, I think that's a question that she's always asking herself, too. I think where we meet her, she's in a very bad place in her life. She's drinking a lot. She's very promiscuous. She's working at a bar and getting in fights with big men. And she's just one of them, like, no BS, you know, kind of women. She's always getting arrested and stuff. And the more we peel the layers back, then the more we see what got her to this dark place in her life. And I think Freedom is one of those people, especially like in the past 20 years, she's kind of going through this identity crisis and she doesn't quite know who she is either. And I think she just is so so concerned with just drowning her grief and drinking, you know, the night away and getting arrested that she doesn't even care, you know, and she's just one of them very indifferent people who is just slowly killing herself. She also has her suicide jar. She's collecting her medications until her suicide jar is full, and then she, you know, plans on taking her own life. However, the catalyst is her estranged daughter going missing, and that forces her to just move. And I think through there, she starts to find herself and kind of like discover herself. So
you would say that she kind of has a death wish and is kind of very reckless in the things that she does, which makes it interesting because you don't know what she's going to do next.
Exactly. But I think while that's like one of her biggest weaknesses is her like reckless life, it's also one of her biggest assets. She's one of those people, she doesn't really fear a lot. And I think that's a lot of how she gets so far in her journey to find her daughter, is because she really is this fearless, reckless woman who really doesn't think about the consequences. She'll just, you know, do anything at all costs. And I think that's her best asset as well as her biggest weakness.
Now, do you think that, when do you think, and let's just look at her as a person, when do you think the psyche broke? When do you think that this became the person that she is now? What do you think was that kind of splitting of the atom, I guess you want to say, that turned her maybe into this reckless person?
I'd say 100% was when she put her children up for adoption. I think that's when she snapped and she went into this long, very long downward spiral. That's 100% when she snapped, I think. But it's also the one thing that kind of snaps her out of it is having that purpose, because for the past, you know, 18 or 20 years without her children, she's lost that purpose for living. And with her daughter gone missing and her, she's going to find her daughter, that's now her purpose, and it's that drive.
And what was one of your biggest challenges? I mean, because this is a debut novel, so, you know, you had a long time to kind of sit and massage it and get it to the way, you know, that you want it to be. But what was one of your biggest challenges? You know, what was the thing that you kind of struggled with in getting the book done?
You know, it really wasn't hard for me to write this book because, I mean, like I said, it was very cathartic for me. And I think what Freedom and I have in common is that we're both mothers grieving over the children we had to put up for adoption. So it was very easy for me to write it. I didn't have to fake a lot of that emotion. It's very raw, and I think it comes through on the page is that it's real emotion for me. But the hardest part of the actual writing process, I think, was writing the end, because I already had the last chapter in mind, and I got to that part. I finally got to the end, and I stopped. I stopped for about 8 months, and I just refused to write the last chapter because I didn't want to say goodbye to my friend, you know, Freedom. Mm-hmm. And I know that sounds crazy to the non-writer, but I just did not want to, you know, sever that bond that I created between this fictional character and I. So I knew word for word what the last chapter was, but I refused to write it for months, for about 7 or 8 months.
Did you have any thoughts of when you were getting involved in writing the book that you're like, you know what, I'm going to make this into a series, because you didn't want to let go because you wanted to keep going with Freedom. So maybe this, you know, you're turning this from a standalone more now into a series to keep her journey going.
You know, I think that the thought crossed my mind, but once I started to get a hold of who Freedom was, I realized that she had one of those, you know, open and shut stories. And I think anything, you know, afterwards would just be watering her down. I feel like she had this story, she told it, it's done, move on. And so now I'm just trying to write other books and build, you know, different relationships with different characters. So, but there won't be another Freedom. I'm actually thinking about maybe bringing a couple of the characters back in my other books, you know, just little Easter eggs for the reader. But no, I mean, no real sequel to it.
So nothing like that. Yeah. And I think that, and you never know, you know, 5-6 years down the road, you might be like, I wonder, you know, whatever happened to her? And you might bring her back, explore, and kind of, you know, update
sure.
those kinds of things. So that's the good thing about books, is you're able to do those things. You know, you're able to keep exploring characters and exploring yourself as an author.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I can go so many routes. Now, I haven't put anything in stone. I haven't started yet, but I even had the idea. There's this one bad person in Freedom's Child. Her name is Lynn Delaney, and she's this 600-pound coke-dealing mother-in-law. who is after freedom. Well, like, she sends her sons to go after freedom. And a lot of people love to hate this woman. I mean, me too. So I was actually thinking maybe I'll write a prequel about her to see how she got to the point where she was in her life, which is a very, very dark place. And, it's just something I'm kind of toying with. I might do it soon. I might do it 20 years from now. I mean, who knows? But that's the great thing about writing, like you said, is that there's so many doors to knock on, you know?
Mm-hmm. And were there any authors or any kind of books that got you to kind of get over that edge to say, okay, I want to do this, and this is what I want to do, and so then you just started doing it?
No, you know what? It really wasn't from other books and authors. A lot of people ask me that. No, it was film, actually. I am a huge film buff. And yeah, so I was most inspired by film. And I'm one of those people, you know, I've gone to the movie theaters every weekend since 1989, since Tim Burton's Batman. And yeah, I go every weekend. It's like ritual to me. I have to do it every weekend. And in fact, I'm going tonight to see The Martian. And but it's definitely film. And I really took from my favorite films, and especially from the likes of like Quentin Tarantino and Scorsese, one of my favorites of all time. And, I just took from that. And that's really what I did. I pretty much wrote what I wanted to see on the big screen.
And do you think that, you know, writing a book, and were you visualizing it a lot? Were you like looking at each scene saying, okay, how would this look if I'm visualizing it and kind of writing it that way to make it kind of come alive a little bit more on the page?
Yes, absolutely, 100%. In fact, I would have a song that would inspire me, and then I would probably listen to it about 100 times in a row until I kind of saw it like a music video in my head. And then once I had it down pat and I had every word and every movement in this big screen in my head, then I would put it onto paper. So 100%. I have to see it like a movie in my head before I write it down on paper.
And which movies recently have you watched that you've liked? I mean, I haven't been. We just went to the movies last weekend, and I saw Hotel Transylvania 2. I love those kinds of movies. I love Coraline. You know what? I mean, I love those things.
Right.
Gotten a little jaded from some of the movies that I always know kind of how they're going to end, and I kind of just get a little bit bored with the shoot 'em up, and it's like, yeah, I know you're going to kill 1,700 people, and then you're going to come out at the end, and everything's going to be hunky-dory, so I get a little bit bored with that. But what about you? I mean, what kind of movies? You say you're going to see The Martian, which looks very entertaining. It's not a book for me. It's not a movie for me. I'm not really into that. But what have you seen lately? Well,
Well, I think I'm a lot like you, where, you know, it's not the same as it was when I was a kid, you know, like 20 years ago. I mean, now it's a lot of remakes, which I think, you know, it's kind of leave them be. Don't make any more remakes, I think. And it's not as original. It's just not as original. And it's kind of like assembly line blockbusters. But yeah, I mean, it's like Jason Statham dies 12 times before you get sick of it in the same movie. And I think recently, you know, I've been really getting into indie films because I find that their plots are very rich and it's more authentic. There's more originality there. Recently, I'd say one that I really loved, it was a few years back, but I just watched it the other day, is The Place Beyond the Pines, starring Bradley Cooper and Ryan Gosling. And at first I was like, oh, I'm not going to watch a stupid movie with these pretty boys. But I'll tell you, it was fantastic. And I really wish it'd make more films like this. It was just fantastic.
I think the one thing that I've noticed, like you said, from, you know, older films and things like that to now, is it's the writing that really gets on my nerves because, you know, they're going to remake Ghostbusters. Back in the 80s and things, it was such more subtle writing with Ramis and Murray, and now they bring these things out, and then it's just a lot of sex jokes, bodily function jokes that make absolutely no sense. They're really stupid, and I think the writers have gotten lazy. Because if they can't remember what to say, it's like what I always say. They just throw a penis joke in there, or a gay joke, or a lesbian joke, or these
you
things. And I'm
so
like,
right.
They're not even thinking. Yeah, I hate those.
You are absolutely right. And I think more and more, I'm starting to actually put my sights more on television. I think that's where I'm starting to see a lot better writing. Like you know, if you look at Breaking Bad or, you know, a lot of these shows, and it's just genius writing, I think. And, it's just something that's a little bit hard to see in Hollywood these days. So
yeah,
I don't know. TV is kind of where it's at right now.
I mean, a lot of authors, with the explosion of like all these different stations now, and now Netflix and Amazon and Hulu, they're all having their own original series, and they're all going crazy. And I think that the one thing that I enjoy the most, I think that, you know, if I was an author, I would rather my books be made into TV series more than a movie, just because they can be explored a lot more in depth with the characters.
I'm so happy
that, you know, like Craig Johnson and Longmire, I love watching that, but if it was a movie, it would be done and over, and then you have to wait, you know, 2 years for the next one. We're here, I got 4 seasons, and I get to see this whole progression of how these things happen.
Yeah, you know what? And I really think with a TV, the writers have a lot more legroom to play with, and I think that they can see, you know, okay, well, this is what happened in the book, but we think it would do better for the audience if we did this. And, you know, it's a lot of back and forth, and it's really cool. Like right now, we're starting to work on the film version of Freedom's Child. And I can see already they're cutting characters, they're cutting scenes.
Right.
I'm always one of those people. I really can't stand when people say, oh, I like the book better. I don't think that's fair, because I think film and books are two completely different, you know, arts. I think they're two different forms of entertainment.
Because I say the same thing to people. I say the same thing.
I'm telling you, it's like, no, you don't like the book better. You like the act of reading better. You like that form of escapism better. And, you know, so I'm not mad that they're cutting scenes and cutting characters. I mean, I understand it's very hard to put a 400-page book into a 120-page script. So with movies, I think you get to have more of what the original author saw, because you have more room to play with. You can add more characters. You can add more locations because you have the space and time to do it, which you don't have in film.
Right. Movies speed things up. TV slows things down. Right. And I think that that's a
big
difference.
Right.
That in a movie, everything has to be sped up to get to the end. You can't really, you know, slow things down. You have to speed them up because you only got that hour and a half, hour, 45 minutes. But TV, you can slow things down and progressively build. You don't have to, everything doesn't have to be a rush, rush, rush. But, yeah, I do agree when people say, well, the book was better than the movie. I'm like, if the book was exactly, if the movie was 100% exactly like the movie, or you know, like the book, would you go watch it? Because you know it already. Don't you want a
Absolutely
little variation?
Not. Absolutely not. And, like, if you took Freedom's Child and put it on the big screen, the way I see it, it would literally be a 40-hour movie.
Right.
And that's how I see it in my head. There is no way that you can, you know, at least
You can't do it.
You can't
it's
just
impossible.
Put a book. You know, you can't. You can't. Now if you take smaller books, like you know, if you take a novella, like if you look at Shawshank Redemption or Stand By Me by Stephen King, two great movies.
Short stories.
And they were fantastic. They were fantastic because he was able to add more. He was able to do a lot with it because they were much shorter stories.
But then if you go to the flip side, The Stand or It could have never been done in one movie. It had to be the longer. It was like, you know, was 4 hours
miniseries. Yeah.
The Stand was the miniseries. Mm-hmm. And The Langlowers were the miniseries. It had to be that way. So he's like a very perfect example that had to be done that way. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah,
so,
I totally agree.
I mean, with Freedom's Child, I always dreamed of it being a movie, so I'm really excited because, I mean, I think it is a little bit original. It's not that assembly line blockbuster where you have the action figure dying, you know, 10 times in a row. It's not huge explosions. It's a good story, I think, at least for film. So we'll see. I actually don't have, like, any say in the film, so I'm just as eager to see.
Yeah, you know, I think that a lot of fans get upset with the author. Because I think they do think that the author does have some kind of a say. And they're like, well, why did you let them do this? It's like, I had no say in anything. They bought the rights, which
some
means they do what they want.
Some authors do, but you
got to be a Stephen King, Dean Koontz, Lee Child status, I think, before you're like, or J.K. Rowling, before it's like, yeah, I'm going to have control over my book.
Right. But I'll tell you the truth, I don't think I would really like so much control, you know, with the film adaptation of my book. Like, I've been trying to write screenplays. I'm working on my first one now, and I'll tell you, I hate it. I didn't enjoy it. It's very tedious with the formatting. It's too technical. I can't be inside their heads, you know, and I just find it very, very hard. Even though I love film more, I cannot write a script to save my life. I'm learning.
And I think that's why a lot of screenwriters would love to become novelists, because they are able to explore that into a little bit more. I mean, there's a lot of screenwriters or a lot of novelists I know that used to be in screenwriting and they hated it, and they're so happy that they're able to kind of get out of it now. Because they just didn't kind of like that.
Them.
They didn't like that. Yeah, they didn't like that style. So I guess what I'm going to say is, you know, like, what's coming up next for you now that, of course, you know, Freedom's Child is out and it's doing very successful and you're doing very well. Now you kind of have a little bit of pressure because now a lot of fans want to know, well, what's coming next and kind of what's on your mind and what are you getting involved with? You hinted a little bit, but can you kind of go into the future a little bit and let people know what they can expect?
Yeah, well, Freedom is part of a 2-book contract, so I'm under a lot of pressure right now because I sent my manuscript in and it needs major surgery, but it's pretty much, it's going to be like a documentary, which I also love as much as film, only on paper, and it explores the 14-year-old daughter of a serial killer from the point of view of a documentarian 20 years later. So, it's a lot like Freedom. It's very gritty. It's very violent. It explores the seedy parts of Americana, like rednecks and meth labs and all that fun stuff. That's pretty much it. So I'm working on that, but I have, like, 7 other books I'm working on, but I have to put on the back burner for now. But, yeah, that's the one thing I'm working on today. So.
Well, and that sounds fascinating. And now are you exploring – are you going to be getting involved in stuff that you're going – like I said, that I always like to ask authors – you know, what's going to be, you know, the challenge that you're setting in this book to yourself as a writer? Like, okay, I want this part of my writing to be a little bit better than I did the last time, because you're always continually learning with your craft. So is there something that fans will see more in the second book as a change maybe from your writing of Freedom's Child?
You know, I'm not so sure, because I think with Freedom, there was so much, you know, heart and soul into it because it was very parallel to my own life. And I think that the second one is probably a little more commercial, yet I am trying to, you know, better myself every day, and especially like with these new deadlines that I have with the first one, there's a little bit more pressure. But I'm really enjoying exploring different parts of America, and I try to put, you know, a lot of bits in there that you don't commonly see in literature. Like right now I'm writing about the Mexican cartel. In the second book. So I really like that. I really like exploring places that a lot of people don't want to explore or at least don't want to write about in fiction. So that's, you know, a real challenge to me, you know, especially in, like, research, because, I mean, if you type in Mexican cartel in Google Images, God knows what comes up. So it is a little bit challenging, but it's also fun at the same time.
As far as research goes, because, you know, you are researching a subject that you really probably don't want to go to Mexico and get involved with cartels to understand them from the inside. So how is it for you? How are you able to kind of to do that? And the other question real quick is there a subject matter that you just won't tackle because it is too dark?
You know what? I think that this one's a little bit different for me as far as research, because I actually have a stepfather who's from Mexico, and his life has been affected by the Mexican cartel. So I'm able to talk to my stepfather and get a lot of research that way. So that's good. So I don't have to go to Tijuana and visit people, you know, firsthand, because it is dangerous down there right now. As far as subjects I don't want to tackle, probably not. I will tackle pretty much anything. I think the most controversial part of Freedom's Child was a fanatical Christian, you know, suicide doomsday cult. And now it's the Mexican cartel. I don't really think there's much I won't touch. I'm not sure yet. Mm-hmm. If there is, I haven't thought about it.
You haven't come across it yet if there is one, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and I guess a lot of authors, you know, a lot of them say that they won't delve too well into children and things like that. And I can understand that, of course, because if you have children, you really don't want to dive into that, or, you know, maybe like the human trafficking kind of thing, just because it is takes you just to a really dark place. But I think that any subject matter, if done properly and written well, I don't think there's anything that really is untouchable, because it's life and we're living it and it is out there. So I think that it is important that fans see it, even if it's in a fictional side or a non-fictional side, that these things are true, maybe. So I kind of agree that there really isn't a subject, but I think that there's tasteful ways to write subjects like that.
I was just going to say, it really is a matter of taste because, like, especially in my, in both books, I mean, in Freedom's Child, we're dealing with a cult and there's a man who's, with a bunch of 13 and 14-year-olds and impregnating them. And in my second book, it was originally told as the 14-year-old girl in the Mexican cartel. So needless to say, there are a lot of difficult subject, matters in there. And I think it is, about taste. I mean, I don't go into brutal detail. I mean, I think that can be left to the reader's imagination. I mean, you don't have to spell it out for them,
Right.
And stuff like, hurting children and rape and incest and a lot of these issues. I mean, don't spell it out for them because then you're just insulting the reader's intelligence. They know what's going on. So that's how I look at it,
I agree. Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on, Jax, and I want to give you the last, 30 seconds to let everybody know where they can find you and find out about you, social media. So go ahead and let everybody know where all that stuff is.
Okay, so I have a website, jaxmiller.com. I never use it, so it's probably not the best way to find me. I am found on Twitter. It's my handle is at @JaxMillerAuthor, and the same thing for Facebook. If you look under Jax Miller Author, you'll find me. And I think Facebook's the best way to get in touch with me. I'm always on Facebook. So.
Yeah. And Ireland right now, and is that where you live full time?
Yeah. I've been here about 4 years now with my husband. I love it here. And I guess it was a little bit of a culture change. I was coming from New York, and now I'm here in a county Meath. So I'm about half an hour from Dublin, but I'm with rolling hills and cattle farms. It's a very different world here, but I love it.
Yeah, it's probably a much different world from New York.
It is. But it's a nice pleasant change. I mean, I'm at a point in my life I kind of want things quiet now, so I'm in the perfect spot.
Oh, I agree with that wholeheartedly. So, well, again, Jax, we want to thank you so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure to speak with you. Great congratulations
on
that debut novel, Freedom's Child. And, again, we look forward to seeing what you have going on, and keep us up to date on the film so we can update people on, what's going on with that. So let us know.
All right, definitely. Thank you so much, John.
All right, bye-bye. So, again, everybody, that is author Jax Miller. Go to jaxmiller.com to find out more information about the book and things that are going on. And, of course, you can go ahead and contact her through her Facebook, Twitter, and all that fun stuff, too, and make sure you stay yourself up to date. We are going to take another short break. We'll be back. We're just waiting for our next guest to call in, Joe Clifford. He is the author of a book called Lamentation. We were to speak with him. Have never spoken with him before, so it's always great to talk with new authors. And we'll be right back after this.
Problems. It's so easy to play up your breakdown.
So welcome back, everybody, here after the break. Again, to Suspense Radio Inside Edition. Today, on October the 3rd, 2015, we're still waiting for our guest, Joe Clifford, to call in. Not sure if he's going to make it. As you know, I do not hang around much too much longer if people do not call in. Otherwise, I'm just not going to sit here and talk for a half hour when I really have nothing prepared to say because I don't really care to do those things. But again, I will say I want you to check out SuspenseMagazine.com and check out those 8 films to die for. Just look at the trailers, a couple, 2.5 minutes long. It won't take long if you look at the trailer. You can do it any time and see what you think. We're going to have some stuff in the magazine with them. We are looking at doing some things in 2006. Possibly Jeff Ayers and I are my host on Beyond the Cover. We are looking at doing some new things in 2016, doing some original programming on our radio show. We are going to be writing some things up and having some maybe half-hour-long productions of stories that we're going to do. Of course, if anybody's interested in that, we will always take, you know, your thoughts and your emails, and you can go ahead and email us and stuff, and, you know, we might take some guest writers and see what we can do. But we are looking to do something here, like I said, a little bit different. We want to make a great experience for everyone on the radio show with the magazine. And that's something that we're always looking to do. The magazine's going to be having some changes. We're going to add some things in there, of course, for 2016. There's always something new. Look for that. We're working with the FBI on this front. And so when we get that done more, we'll have some more information on that. Our best of 2015 is coming up. That's going to be in December. It's going to be in later December this year than normally. And we are starting to put those lists together. And, of course, not every book is out, but we have to start compiling something. And we're going to see who's going to be the winner of our Crimson Scribe Award. Last year it was I Am Pilgrim by Terry Hayes. So we're going to see who he's going to pass the torch along to this year going forward. Well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to end the show now. I want to thank everybody for joining us. Tasha Alexander, Jack Miller on the show. Make sure you check us out here on SuspenseRadioNetwork.com, SuspenseMagazine.com. For more information on this show and all the shows that we have going on, Beyond the Cover will be back on Monday, then the Story Blender on Friday, and Crime and Science Radio next Saturday. So until then, everybody, we want to say thank you for joining us, however, whenever, and wherever you listen to the show. And as always, keep reading. Goodbye.